This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Party Girl by Rachel Hollis, performed by the author. For Mama, who gave me wings, and for Daddy, who taught me how to use them. Chapter 1. I'm singing, or really, bellowing might be a better word. My voice is miserable, and I'm a far cry from Miley, who's wailing from my iPod dock, but I'm too happy to care. This is the very first day of my very first real job, in my very first week, in my very new city. This is the first day of the rest of my life, and I'm going to kick this day's butt. Watch out, L.A. Landon Brinkley is here, and she's belting out every word of this song like her life depends on it. I wrap another piece of long blonde hair around the outside of the flat iron and stare at my reflection in the mirror while the curl heats to perfection. My big blue eyes shine back, outlined on all sides by the perfect shade of teak liner. The few clusters of individual lashes I added are definitely the right choice. They really stand out against the shimmery champagne coating on my lids. The eyeshadow matches the MAC lip gloss in glittery pink I've bought just for this day. There's a little shimmer in my bronzer, too, so my makeup ties in beautifully with the gold rhinestones lining the color of my fitted pink cardigan. I smile at my own shining reflection. All the light-catching glimmer is gorgeous, and so me. If I had a power color, it would definitely be sparkle. I work the last length of hair down through the flat iron, creating the ideal bouncy curl I perfected in the 7th grade. The door to the bathroom bursts open behind me, and I try not to flinch when Max glares at me through mascara-smudged eyes. Her dark pixie cut is sticking up in every possible direction, and I gather from the deep creases running down one side of her face that however few hours she's been in bed, she slept all of them on that cheek. I'm sorry, is the music too loud? I smile sheepishly and lower the volume. Miley isn't appropriate at any time of day. But before 8 is ridiculous for anyone over the age of 11, she says with a scowl. She rubs one eye aggressively and pushes a hand through her hair. The movement jangles a pile of bracelets she never seems to remove from her left wrist. Her pajamas are an oversized t-shirt with a picture of a muscle car and the words, "My other ride is your mom," stamped across the front. Charming. I hope she's got underwear on, but the shirt's hanging down too low to tell. She's clearly comfortable walking around the apartment wearing just a top, and I suppose if I were that thin and tall and had legs that long, I'd probably run around naked. I sigh. At 5'3", I suppose it's my lot in life to forever envy anyone taller than I am. Oh well, a little tease and a back comb, and my hair gets me at least 2 inches closer to heaven. Oh, come on, she's edgier now. She got that crazy haircut. I try. We can't even debate this topic. My brain cells are literally dying right now in an attempt to contemplate something so inane. She doesn't even look at me as she speaks, just walks across the space of the small bathroom, pulls down the underwear that were indeed hidden by her shirt, and sits down on the toilet. I want to act cool, like finishing my makeup while she pees 3 feet from me is totally normal. But we've been roommates for exactly 6 days. And during that time, we've spent the sum total of 40-something minutes together. I'm not a prude or anything, but Lord, let's ease into this, shall we? Why are you even awake this early? Max grumbles, standing back up. It's my first day, remember? I sound way too perky, even to my own ears. Oh yeah, well, good luck. I've heard Selah's a total asshole. I start to ask her what that means, but she's already yawning out the door, presumably to sleep until the afternoon. I take one last look in the mirror and then head into my room to grab my purse. My bed is already made and covered with throw pillows in various shades of purple. Max made fun of the fact that I was already unpacked with pictures hung and clothes organized by style by the end of my first day here, but I can't stand disorganization. I told her that when she interviewed me on the phone for the roommate position. She told me she was the polar opposite, but that she was home so rarely it shouldn't be an issue. Then she said that if I could cover half of the $1,650 monthly rent and promise not to bring home any douchebags, her words, not mine, I could move in. And $825 later, I had a place to live in Hollywood. I still smile every time I think about my new zip code. I step into the pumps patiently waiting next to my bed and reach for my purse. Even though it's a couple months old, I grin every time I look at this bag. It's a velour juicy daydreamer in bubblegum pink with satin bows and gold charms. I saved my tips for months to get it. I don't usually buy anything so expensive, but it was so worth it. I glance at the clock on my phone. It's 8:17 a.m. Perfect. I have just enough time to head down to the garage, get on the road, and drive from my apartment to my new office in Beverly Hills. I might even get there a little before 9 and have a chance to grab some coffee. Beverly Hills. Eek! I almost can't believe it. I've dreamed about moving to L.A. for most of my life, and now I'm here. The ancient elevator doors open to reveal our apartment's underground garage, which apparently always smells like trash no matter what day it is. With every step, the butterflies in my stomach seem to grow in size and strength. I start whispering the mantra I've said to myself 1,000 times over the last year whenever I've gotten nervous. I am strong. I am smart. I am courageous. I am strong. I am smart. I am courageous. The words are a litany as my heels clip-clop on the cement, and I home in on my battered Ford Explorer. I had it washed once I got here to get rid of the millions of bugs that were murdered against the windshield on the drive through 4 states, but it still looks beat up. Even if the license plate weren't from Texas, the SUV with its custom Longhorns trailer hitch would be out of place on LA streets. But it's not like I can afford to get anything else. I pull out of the garage and am just turning right onto Fountain when my iPhone starts playing I Hope You Dance by Leanne Womack. It's Mama. I hit speakerphone. I'm still not used to this whole hands-free thing in Cali. Hi! Wait, hold on. I thought this lane was clear. Now I'm stuck behind a parked car. Ugh, come on, let me back in. Are you hollering at me, baby? Mama asked cheerfully. No, Mama, I'm trying to... Wait, okay, I'm back in. Sorry, I was trying to merge. How are you? Oh, I'm fine. Just working on my biscuits. In the background, I can hear the rolling pin hit the edge of the counter as she works her dough down to the perfect density. My parents have owned the pit since before I was born. And even though they have plenty of faithful employees, Mama refuses to let anyone else in on her legendary buttermilk biscuit recipe. Even I don't know what she puts in those things. Because a Southern woman would sooner give up her firstborn than share the secrets of her best recipe. The pit is famous for Daddy's barbecue, but no table ever leaves without working their way through at least 2 helpings of Mama's biscuits. Which is why, every day they're open, you'll find Mama in the kitchen making her biscuits. Ooh, I wish I had one right now. I'm starving. Bless your heart. Why didn't you eat something? She asks, concerned. I was too nervous before. I'll grab something later. Baby, don't start skipping meals now. You're already too skinny. Oh, I won't. I was just in a hurry. I wonder what's taking so long. I glance at the clock on my dash. 8:41. What's that, honey? Sorry, it's just I haven't gotten all that far down the street. I don't understand where all this traffic is coming from. I'm supposed to be there in 19 minutes and I'm not even to La Cienega yet. I crane my neck to try and see around the car in front of me. All I see are more cars. All right, girl, I'll let you go. Just wanted to check in. I miss ya. I miss you too, Mama. I'll call you after, okay? I push end and scoot my car forward a scant 2 feet in line. Oh, please, I can't be late. I cry out to the cars in front of me. The clock on the dash reads 8:45. Oh, God, Lord Jesus, I cannot be late on my first day. I don't know if what Max has heard about Selah is true, but I certainly don't want to make a bad impression. Everything I know about my new boss is based on a Google search. She started Selah Smith Events 5 years ago, just after turning 28, and in that short time has become the most publicized event planner ever. SSC has produced some of the biggest celebrity weddings, baby showers, and movie premieres in the last few years, giving each one the stamp of edgy luxury Selah is known for. She isn't just the planner, either. Selah has become a celebrity in her own right, often walking the red carpet at the same event she produced. She's model gorgeous, tall and thin, and her dark brown hair never changes from her signature, severe A-line bob. Selah is easily the coolest woman alive, and I can't believe she's going to be my boss. I had to beg the planner I'd assisted last summer to make a call to her old colleague in Houston. That colleague called someone else in LA, who called someone else, who finally had a contact at SSE. I'd email back and forth with someone named McKenna for nearly 2 months before finally getting a 10-minute phone interview with some girl who was in such a hurry that I never even got her name. After another email from McKenna asking for a picture of myself that was apparently approved, I got a formal offer letter via email. The deal was for a 3-month unpaid internship with the promise that if I proved myself, I'd be offered a permanent position at one of the most successful event agencies on either coast. Unpaid or otherwise, I am beside myself excited by the opportunity. My parents, less so. I'm their only child, so the idea of me leaving our small town in West Texas to move to Los Angeles was more than a little upsetting. But there was really nothing for it. I'd grown up in a big, loud Southern family, surrounded by aunts, uncles, and cousins, with parents who made a huge, fat celebration out of everything. I could set a dinner table with Mama's wedding china by the time I was 4, write out my own invitations by 6, and when I was 13, I saw Jennifer Lopez in the wedding planner. It was the first time I realized there were people whose job it was to throw beautiful events. It's all I've ever wanted to do since. Daddy couldn't fathom a world in which someone would pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for a single party, but he wasn't allowed to complain about my choices since I'd done everything he asked of me first. I'd gone to all 4 years at the state college in the next town over and earned the teaching degree he insisted I have as a fallback. I knew he had secretly hoped I'd find some reason to stay home during those years, but my resolve only grew. I took on every shift I could at the Pit and stockpiled my cash reserve so I could move to L.A. and start the glamorous life I'd always dreamed about. By my calculations, the $9,342 in my savings account can last exactly 5 months. It's a big gamble, but one I'm willing to make in the hopes that I'll be promoted to the job of my dreams. Every single dream I have revolves around me working for the best in events, and that's Selah Smith. I have to go in there and show her what an asset I am to her team. I have to... Crap! The clock on the dash reads 8:58 a.m., and I am nowhere near Beverly Hills. Chapter 2. I'd been so excited to find out that the offices of SSE sit on the busiest part of Beverly Drive, with its cute boutiques and great-looking restaurants, but I barely even noticed them as I sprint down the street in heels. It's 9:22 a.m. by the time the elevator stops at the top floor of the building where SSE is located. The doors open, and I walk into a small reception area. It's all clean lines and stark white. A pretty girl, probably my age, sits at a modern-looking desk in the center of the small space. Behind her, a faux wall with the SSE logo on it separates the reception desk from the large industrial-style office behind her. The whole place looks expensive and gorgeous, and I'd be in awe if I wasn't sick with the knowledge that I am probably never going to work here since I was incapable of showing up on time. I walk over to the desk, but before I can get any words out, the receptionist's phone beeps. She punches a button with her finger and speaks into the microphone of her earpiece. SSE? Yes, absolutely. She punches a few buttons and looks up at me waiting. Hi, I'm... As the phone beeps again, the receptionist's finger flies up, the universal signal for, I'll be with you in a second. SSE? Yes, may I ask who's calling? One moment. She jabs the buttons again, and I wonder fleetingly if she takes out her frustration on that poor phone. She speaks into her headset. Hi, I have Meryl for you? I don't know. You know she never remembers your direct line. Okay, here she is. She abuses the phone again, then looks up at me. I'm... The phone beeps, and that single digit flies up again, telling me to hold on. I'm already so late. My chances of keeping this job are depleting with every call she takes. When she looks up at me again, I pounce. Hi there. I'm Landon Brinkley, I explain. And... Her eyes narrow, and because her hair is pulled back in such a tight ponytail, I think it has to be painful to make that expression. I'm starting my internship today? Of course you are, she says sarcastically. Who's your contact? Oh, my contact is McKenna. Gosh, now that I think about it, I don't actually know her last name, I laugh nervously. The receptionist is not amused. She punches numbers into the phone. Hi, there's an intern here for you? Okay. As she listens to whoever is on the phone, she looks at me with even further disdain. Crap. Crappity crap crap. You were supposed to be here at 9, she says. It's the nail in my coffin. I can tell by her tone. Normally I would grovel or cry or start apologizing profusely, but I know instinctually it won't make any difference. I'm gonna have to lie. I hate lying, and I'm terrible at it, but it's my only option if I want to keep this job. There must be some confusion. I try and sound as authoritative as she does. I was told to be here at 9:30. In fact, I came a bit early in case I couldn't find parking. Jeez, my first day on the job in LA and already my moral compass is bent sideways. She says she was supposed to be here at 9:30. She speaks into her headset. I don't know. Yes. She gives me a quick once-over. Cute enough, I guess. Okay. She stabs the phone with her finger and looks back up at me. Wait over there. She nods in the direction of the modern white lounge furniture set up in the corner. The phone beeps again, and she looks down, dismissing me. I sag in relief. I don't think I'm out of the woods yet, but at least they didn't throw me out. I walk over to the waiting area, trying not to let my heels make too much noise on the polished cement floor. I'm too nervous to sit down, so I stand next to the fancy sofa and stare at the framed photos that hang on the wall. They're a montage of sorts, hung gallery style with images of various sizes and shapes. Each picture shows elements of different events. Modern centerpieces at a cocktail party, a long elegant dinner table set for at least 30 people, red carpet arrivals of various movie premieres. Each image is more gorgeous than the last, evidence of a designer with exceptional taste and an unlimited budget. You're lucky I couldn't find the email with your arrival time, a voice says from behind me. I whirl around to face the handsome, perfectly dressed man-child standing next to the reception desk. He's not much taller than I am, and dressed like a professor from the 1950s, with his oversized glasses and his bow tie. His outfit fits his thin frame to perfection, and each piece, slacks, button-down, dress shoes, is black and stands out against the all-white decor in the office. I'm sorry, what? I ask, confused. He smirks. I said, you're lucky that I can't find the email proof that your start time was 9. I know for a fact you're late, but you get some credit for having the balls to lie about it. Follow me. He turns on his heel and starts walking off. I have no choice but to hurry after him. Balls? Behind the faux wall, SSE is a hive of activity. The office is one large industrial-style room, with desks that look like white glass cubes, and is cooler than any workspace I've ever seen. The desks are arranged in a perfect rectangle of 3 rows of 5. Even with big desktops, most of the workstations are overcrowded with paper, magazines, linen samples, centerpiece mock-ups, and invitations in every style imaginable. The employees are going at a feverish pace on computers, on phone calls, on design samples, on mood boards. It's cooler and prettier than I ever could have imagined. As I hurry to follow the professor, I notice the white decor continues in this room, too. Everything, the walls, the desk, the oversized Mac screens are all stark white. In contrast, the staff of SSE, who are 15 or so of the prettiest under 30 set I've ever seen, are dressed just like the professor and the receptionist. In all black. I look down at my polka dot pencil skirt, my blue blouse, my pink cardigan, and the bubblegum purse in my hand. Crap. At the far end of the office, walls of opaque glass create one large room and a smaller one next to it. I follow the professor into the latter. He closes the door behind me and takes a seat at one of the 2 desks in the room. He puts a headset on while waving at me to take the chair next to his desk. Okay. We're off to a bit of a rocky start here, Brinkley. You and I both know you were late, but since I can't prove it, I'm giving you until the end of the day to impress the hell out of me, or you can pack off to whatever quaint hamlet in West Virginia you hail from. Nope, he cuts me off. Not interested in whatever you're about to say. I don't have the time or the inclination to hear your excuses. I've got work to do. You want to be a part of that or not? I'm so embarrassed and don't trust myself to speak without breaking into tears. Instead, I nod. He nods once in response and types quickly on his laptop. His iPhone chirps and he grabs it and reads the screen while talking. There are three things you need to remember here at all times. First of all, nobody wants to hear what you think. I must wince or something because he looks annoyed. That's not me being an asshole. That's just a fact. Interns are a dime a dozen, and everyone whose opinion does matter has earned the right to that position. So keep your mouth shut. Secondly, whatever someone asks you for, they needed it yesterday. We're constantly handling millions of dollars worth of events at one time, and the pace here is fast. If you can't keep up, you'll get run over like roadkill. Got it? Sure, Nope. He cuts me off again. Remember, I'm not interested. Just nod, please. I nod. You'll be working directly for me, and I work directly for Quaid. Quaid, of course, works directly for Selah. Just do whatever either of us ask you to do as fast as possible without fucking it up. Understand? I nod again. Okay, come with me. I stand, place my bag under the small chair next to his desk, and follow him just outside the door. He points to a low bookshelf that runs the length of the frosted glass of the office wall. It holds a mess of binders in every color, some half hanging off the shelf and some lying on their sides. Colorful pages have been ripped out of magazines and haphazardly inserted here and there in the lineup. Organize these. He points at the mess. Is there a particular order y'all want them in, or... I ask before I remember that I'm not supposed to be speaking. Oh, she'll hate that accent. You better do something about it. He turns to walk away while I stare after him, dumbfounded. What? How is that even something to hate? I can't help the way I talk. I want to tell him to shove it, and that I'm from Texas, not West Virginia. I want to mention how hard I've worked to get here today, and that I won't have it destroyed by some snobby, overdressed jerk. But I don't say any of those things. I just stand there and stare at his back as he goes to turn the corner. And before I can think better of it, I call out, "What's your name?" He turns back. "I thought you realized." He walks towards me with his hand out, apparently finding or faking some manners. "I'm McKenna." "You're McKenna?" I say, shaking his hand. "I've never met a man named McKenna. I didn't realize who you were." "My name is Will. But as far as Selah's concerned, I'm McKenna. And Samantha's Quaid, and you'll be Brinkley. It's last names only here." "But my name is Landon," I say, more confused than defiant. McKenna cocks his head to one side and smirks. "Don't you get it? Nobody cares what your name is, Kansas. You'll either fade into oblivion or find some way to earn your keep. The means by which you make your impression are up to you. But in either case, your name is irrelevant." With that, he turns and goes back into the little office. I stand there a moment, perplexed. I'd always known people in L.A. were going to be tougher than people from back home, but I hadn't expected them to be so openly rude. Oh well, not much I can do about it now. I look down at the offensive bookshelf. I might not be able to make McKenna like me, but this cluttered disaster I can handle. I start pulling binders off the shelves and get to work. I don't know how long I've been down on the glazed cement floor, but it's gotta be hours because my knees hurt like hell. Even still, I've managed to organize each of the binders into some semblance of order. It took a while, but eventually I discovered that these binders are inspiration books filled with tear sheets. Every binder housed a different party element, and I'd labeled each one appropriately with a little label maker I'd found buried on the shelf. Some were obvious. Centerpieces, candles, tablecloths in solid colors, and tablecloths in patterns. Others took a little more thought to figure out, and in some cases required a bold-faced assumption. Those included things like fish-based appetizers, unique cocktail vessels, and atmosphere/air. This last binder was filled with images of bubbles and smoke. I took a guess. Now that each binder has a label, I set out to alphabetize and place them back on the shelf. I grab the first stack and begin to sort through them on the floor around me. I'm on my third stack when I hear the clip of heels coming in my direction. I look up just as a willowy brunette with a perfect A-line bob and an angry-looking girl with pin-straight black hair both come to a stop next to my binder city. I look up in awe. Sayla is easily one of the prettiest people I've ever seen in real life. She's also the only person in the room wearing color, well, besides me. She's in tight gray slacks that hug her long legs and an ivory blouse that's only partially tucked in messy perfection. Her black ankle boots have a peep toe and gold buttons laced over black suede. I can see the red peeking out from their bottoms, and even I know how expensive that makes them. I smile up at her. She's so cool, exactly like I knew she'd be. Every single thing about her is crisp, tailored perfection. She's my biggest idol come to life, and she's glaring at me like I'm the blight on her otherwise perfect day. McKenna comes out of his office to meet her, but before he can say anything, she speaks in an overly loud voice as if she needs everyone in the room to pay attention. Isn't there something else this girl could be doing with her time other than cluttering up my floor? I hold my breath, too terrified to respond. McKenna told me that no one cared what I had to say. It doesn't escape me that Sayla spit the words, "this girl," with the same venom one might use to say the words "crack addict" or "puppy rapist." My stomach is churning. I'd imagined meeting Sayla Smith for years. I had it all planned out. I was going to tell her how much I loved her design aesthetic and how the Pucci tablecloth she used for Margot Reeves' 50th birthday party set the stage for one of the prettiest tablescapes I'd ever seen. I never imagined she'd hate me before I'd even opened my mouth, or that she'd blow away just as quickly as she arrived with her two minions in tow, leaving me sitting on the floor with a binder labeled "Animal Entertainment, Mammals" on my lap. I'm still staring down at the binder when a pair of scuffed black combat boots come into view on the floor next to me. I look up at a petite Asian girl with wild, choppy, shoulder-length hair in an outfit of perfectly styled disarray. She's wearing all black, but her ensemble is a bit edgier than the sharp designer duds everyone else has on. She looks down at the binder on my lap and then back into my eyes with a serious expression. "A definition of a mammal?" she asks without preamble. I'm a little nonplussed by the question, so I hesitate for a moment. Unsure of what else to do, I answer. "Animals that nurse their babies? And the Secretary of State?" She's still staring intently at me. "John Kerry? Before him? Hillary Clinton? Capital of Uruguay. Is this girl crazy? Montevideo? Your opinion of Kesha? She's kind of gross looking, but her music's good for cardio." Her serious expression is replaced quickly by a genuine smile. "May I ask why you're asking such odd questions?" She looks surprised by my curiosity, as if the definition of mammal is a valid topic in the intern interview process. "They call me Jin," she says, sticking out her hand. Each nail is perfectly manicured in neon yellow. "What's your name?" "I'm Brinkley, I guess." I reach out to shake her hand, and she uses the opportunity to pull me to my feet. "And your actual name is Landon." "Well, Landon Brinkley, most girls who roll through here, and believe me, there are a few, are dumb as a box of rocks. If I'm going to take you under my wing, I have to make sure you're not a moron," she says decisively. "You're going to take me under your wing?" I ask, confused. She considers me for a second, then seems to come to a conclusion with a nod. "Yes, I am. And here's your first lesson. You'll do better with her if you don't show fear." I wasn't afraid. Like hell. Sayla can strike fear into the heart of an intern from a mile away. She giggles. "Have they given you a break or let you eat lunch or anything?" I look nervously in the direction Sayla has gone. Is this some test? Like if I admit I haven't eaten today or that I have a functioning bladder, she'll tear around the corner and call me girl again? My new friend must sense my hesitation. "Don't worry. They're in an update meeting. They won't be out for at least an hour. Come on, I'll give you a tour." When I still don't move, she giggles. "She'll hate you even more if you piss yourself, and there's far too much white upholstery around here to risk it. But if for some miraculous reason they pull their heads out of their asses long enough to check on you, I'll tell them I needed you for a project. Alec and Jane won't mess with me, I promise." Even though I don't feel much like smiling, my mouth twitches at her comment. I consider not saying anything, but the book nerd in me can't ignore it. "Twilight? Really?" I ask with mock incredulity. Her smile just grows bigger. "The fact that you got the Nebulous Volturi reference only means you're at least as big a nerd as I am. Come on, For someone so petite, she certainly seemed sure of herself. With one more glance at the forbidding closed office door, I follow along after her. Jin, whose first name is actually Miko, shows me to the bathroom first. Thank God. Next is the kitchen, where I gratefully grab some string cheese and carrot sticks from the fridge. I've never been so appreciative of free communal snack food in my life, even if it's all suspiciously healthy. Miko shows me where to get coffee, where the printers are, how to find office supplies, and then how everything is laid out. Every single part of the office is sleek and gorgeous and some variation of glass, chrome, and white. I'm afraid to touch any of it. Miko, as it turns out, is part of the design team. In fact, the head of the design team. It's a little hard to believe because she can't be older than 25, but I clearly don't know anything, so I choose not to question it. There's also a production department and an in-house floral team that is in what Miko calls full crisis mode about some shipment of orchids that's stuck in customs. Apparently, full crisis mode happens a lot around here. Next, I meet a man named Revere, whose highlights are better than mine and whose black ensemble is almost entirely silk. He's the head of the culinary arts team. I'm guessing that means catering? At some point on the quick tour, I ask about the whole last name thing, and Miko sighs dramatically. Just another one of Sayla's edicts. She tells anyone who asks that it's chic and catchy, but really she doesn't like anything she can't control. She says if our parents could be trusted to choose good names, we wouldn't be forced to forgo them in her presence. Evidently, she's never met a first name yet that meets with her approval, and now it's just a thing that everyone accepts. They're like pod people. No one here even questions it anymore. If you meet them outside of work, they'll still only go by their last name. Gosh, I guess it's a good thing everyone has a nice last name then. Ha! Hardly! Revere's last name is actually Warkenstein. No way he was ever going to get away with that. He changed it before she could even ask. So now his alias is an alias. It's ridiculous. I can't help laughing along with her. It is sort of ridiculous. But clearly Sayla knows something about what it means to be cool, chic, and elegant because everywhere I look, the assembled groups are working on beautiful things. I so badly want the opportunity to work on those things too. And if the only way to beautiful flowers and silk linens is through a bunch of messy binders, then by God, I'm going to organize the heck out of them. Hours later, I'm still on the floor putting the last of the binders onto the shelves when I hear a little snap, snap, snap. I look around me, unsure where the noise is coming from. Then I hear it again. I turn my head and see fingers snapping aggressively, reaching beyond the frame of the door of the small office. I jump up and hurry towards the angry hand. Inside the small office, both Quaid and McKenna are barking orders into their headsets and simultaneously punching the keys on laptops in rapid succession. I stand awkwardly in the doorway. I have no idea what to do next. McKenna glares at me and removes one manicured hand from his keys long enough to point at a post-it on the edge of the desk. I walk over quickly and pick it up. Scribbled, in near-illegible handwriting, is a coffee order. It isn't entirely clear what the order is, but based on the penmanship, I'm guessing it's written by a serial killer. "You want me to go pick this up?" I whisper. He covers the mouthpiece of his headset with one hand. Obviously. I look at the list again. Q. Large BLK. Mick. Small. No. Large BLK. SS. SFV / iSplendid / extreme / extra ice. Ice blended? Like a blended iced coffee? Or is that a specific thing from a specific coffee place?
"I'm sorry to bug you, but is this from a specific..."
McKenna pushes the mute button on his phone and swings around to where I'm nervously clutching the neon-colored post-it.
"If you can't pick up a simple coffee order, what makes you think you can handle an actual job?" he sneers.
"I suggest you figure it out quickly. Sayla's leaving in 20 minutes for a meeting and better have a coffee in her hand when she goes."
"Right."
I turn quickly and rush to grab my bag. 20 minutes to drive to get special coffee from I don't know where and be back here. Crap. How am I going to pull this off? I look around me in a small panic, as if the answer will be painted on the wall or something.
Miko and the design team are deep in discussion about some kind of room layout printed on a poster-sized piece of paper that takes up the space of a whole desk. I'd love to ask her for advice, but I'm hesitant to bug anyone more than I already have. I look down at the list once more and decide to Google it on my cell as I rush towards the door. On the way by Miko's desk, she holds out a magazine towards me.
Brinkley, I need you to pick up this month's edition while you're out.
She says this with a wink and then turns back to her group, most of which don't even acknowledge my presence. I look down at the copy of El Decor in my hands. It's got thick black ink scribbled on the cover. Coffee bean. She'll want it every day. Down the street to your left. Hashtag, death to the Volturi. I am officially in love with this girl. Thanks to Miko's help, I find a place called Coffee Bean that does in fact have something called an ice blended. And when I tell them Sayla's order, they seem to know exactly what I'm asking for. I have a small panic attack when the barista asks if she wants whipped cream or not. It will occur to me later, when I go over this day in my mind, that whipped toppings shouldn't ever be cause for anxiety. But at the time, it seems like a life or death decision. Since I have no idea what the answer is, I decide that someone as skinny as Sayla wouldn't be caught dead with whipped cream on her coffee. It's only when they ring me up that I realize no one gave me money. Am I buying coffee for them now? My budget is definitely not going to accommodate that. I hand over my debit card and decide to figure it out later. I have only 8 minutes to get back. I rush back up the street, balancing the coffee tray while inhaling a stale piece of coffee cake, which was the only pastry left in the display case this late in the afternoon. It's dry and cold, but I'm starving, and therefore it's the most delicious snack ever. I'm back up the elevator and into the small office with 3 minutes to spare. I hold out the tray to McKenna and Quaid, who turn around long enough to grab their own coffees. Neither says thank you. When I stand there waiting for someone to take the last drink from the tray, McKenna nods in the direction of the larger office next door.
You want me to take it to her?
I ask, unsure.
Obviously, he replies and spins back around in his chair. Someone should really explain the definition of the word obvious to McKenna, as in, whatever is obvious should possibly be obvious to people other than him, but whatever. I sheepishly go to the frosted door to Sayla's office and knock.
Yes, she calls from behind the door. I turn the handle and open the door. Sayla sits behind an all-glass table that's twice the size of any single desk I've ever seen. Her office feels very similar to everything in the common area. It's clean, sleek, and luxurious. A set of framed, oversized black and white prints dominate one wall. But beyond that, there's no other photos, no paintings, no colorful throw pillows. Even the expensive-looking flowers on her desk are all white.
Yes?
She asks again, clearly annoyed. I haven't realized I've just been standing in the doorway like an idiot. Way to impress, Landon.
I have your coffee, I say, without moving to step foot in the room.
Bring it. I do as I'm told, removing the drink from the tray on the short trip across her office. I place a napkin down first, set the drink on top of it, and then lay a straw down next to the drink. I straighten up to leave the room.
Why the napkin? She asks without looking up from the screen of her computer.
I want to ask her to clarify the question, but I'm fearful of speaking unnecessarily.
The drink is cold. I didn't want the condensation to drip onto your desk.
I answer very carefully, as if I'm competing in a spelling bee. Intimidated. I-N-T-I-M-I-D-A-T-E-D. Intimidated. Her eyes flicker in my direction for a single heartbeat.
What's your name?
Landon Brinkley? She keeps typing. Should I keep standing here? Should I go? I have no idea.
That'll be all, Brinkley, she says. I smile weakly, even though she's not looking up to see it, and leave the office.
Next door, Quaid and McKenna are still hunched over their laptops. As soon as I walk in, McKenna speaks.
You survived day one, Mississippi. You can go. I hope I don't need to tell you that a similar ensemble will not be allowed inside this building tomorrow.
Quaid snorts quietly. I blush all the way down to my toes.
So I'm done for the day? You are, in fact. Just a reminder, we start at 9. I suggest you don't forget it. Of course. Thank you so much for the Taylor Smith's office. McKenna chirps into his earpiece. And once again, I'm dismissed. I slam the driver's side door of my car and melt into the familiar seat. I feel like I've been holding my breath the entire day, and now that I've let it out, I have an overwhelming urge to cry. God, this day hasn't turned out at all like I thought it would. I've made so many mistakes, and people were so mean. I guess I thought I'd make some friends. The first traitorous tear slides down my cheek, and I swipe at it angrily with my palm. No, you will not cry. I tell myself furiously. I am strong. I am smart. I am courageous. I throw the car into reverse and make my way out of the congested garage and onto Beverly. I am strong. I am smart. I am courageous. It's just, I've been dreaming of this day for so long, and I thought maybe I'd get to learn about events or help with something creative or... Another tear falls. Nope. We are not going to do this. I drag my index finger below my lash line to clean away whatever mascara is trying to pull a Tammy Faye on me. This is what you came here for, Landon? I chastise myself. To cry your way home because the big kids are mean to you? I am stronger than this. I will not cry. I will not cry. I will... I need something to focus on. I need the right song. I scroll quickly through the playlist on my phone and find what I'm looking for. When the first few lines of the Taylor Swift song come on, I already feel better. I crank the volume until the windows shake with the twang of her guitar strings in my crappy stereo. By the time the chorus hits, I'm belting the words along with her and slamming my hand down on the steering wheel to punctuate our shared angst at being picked on by bullies. I'm sure the other cars around me are enjoying the view of the crazy girl crying and singing at the top of her lungs, but I don't care. I don't have time to wallow. I've got a dream job to land. Over an hour later, when I pull into my own parking spot at home, I've cried off all my makeup and most of my eyelashes. But I'm resolved and ready to go back tomorrow and show them that I don't scare easily. Chapter 3. I walk into the Valtori's office the next morning at 8:57 a.m. McKenna is dressed in another set of perfectly tailored slacks, and his pinstripe suit jacket is draped over the back of his chair. I wonder if this professor thing is his signature look. He does a once-over of my all-black ensemble, a dress that can really be described only as cocktail attire, and black pumps. It is one of my few options since I don't really own a lot of black. McKenna's eyes widen slightly, as if I just walked into his office in a clown suit. But I just stand there and smile back at him like I'm competing for Miss America. I've decided that no matter what they say to me today, I'm going to keep this look on my face. Sit. He points to my chair from yesterday that's been rolled into the small space between the open door and the wall. I am literally sitting in the corner. I slide my bag under the chair and look up at him expectantly. Okay, Brinkley, there's no shallow area here. You'll be thrown directly into the deep end. If you can't swim, you'll drown. Got it? I nod. First, you'll need to... He shudders with a tremor of annoyance. Are you going to take notes, or do you have something better to do? Of course, I'm sorry. I scramble for my bag and remove a glittery pink notebook and a matching pen. He starts talking again before I've even cracked the page. First of all, you'll need to speak with Chadwick. He's supposed to have centerpiece options for the Rhinestone after party. Speaking of which, we'll need a collection of decor inspiration, something unique and original for that event. Come up with a list of jewel-themed ideas. You did bring your laptop, correct? No, Go borrow one from Taylor. Don't show up here again without bringing your own. Okay, Now, Brinkley, get the laptop now. He sighs heavily as if dealing with me is the most tedious chore on earth, so I hop to my feet before I can annoy him further. The central office area is at the same level of chaos as yesterday, only with new outfits. I look around, confused. I'm not really sure who Taylor is or where he sits. Rather than embarrass myself by wandering aimlessly, I sneak over to Miko to ask directions. She smiles up at me, but before I can open my mouth, I realize she's on a call. I don't want to bug her. I raise my hand in apology and start to back away, but she covers her phone receiver before I can sneak away. It's okay. What do you need? She whispers. Sorry,
Do you know who Taylor is? I whisper back.
He's the head of production, sits on the far side of the office, but you'll probably find him out in the production room.
Thanks!
Miko smiles and waves after me. I hurry off in the direction that Miko has pointed out and find myself next to the kitchen and a doorway I hadn't really noticed yesterday. I open the heavy door and realize it's actually the entrance to a large workroom, nearly half the size of the entire office. Nirvana is wafting out of a small wireless speaker on a far table, and several guys are unpacking what looks like the leftover accessories from an event. I pause for a moment, unsure of who to ask. Most of the men are on the other side of the room, and one guy is unloading a crate nearby, so I head towards him. He's in black jeans, a black t-shirt, and black leather Converse. His arms are cut around perfect lean muscle, each with a full sleeve of tattoos. And even from back here, he looks like the lead singer of your favorite band. He must hear me tapping over in my heels because he turns around, and I'm surprised at how young he is. He's got dark brown hair and chocolatey eyes, and he's definitely rocking a sort of sexy bad boy look. If I were into the whole Adam Levine thing, I'd probably be drooling right now. Can I help you with something? He smiles down at me, and I hear a little southern twang that somehow softens his sharper edges. Wonder where he's from. I'm so sorry to bother you, but I'm looking for Taylor. Can you help me? He stares at my face more intently. I wonder if he hears my accent, too. I fight the urge to fluff my hair. I'd love to help you, he drawls. Why don't you tell me what you need him for? What is he, the door guard? I don't have time to waste with 20 questions, and I don't want to flirt. I just want to borrow a laptop. I just need to speak with your boss. Can you tell me where Taylor is? He sets down the glass vase he's holding on the table behind him. I'm a little confused, he starts. And I don't want to be rude, but this is already taking way longer than it's supposed to. Can you please just point me towards the head of production? I look around the room trying to figure out who that might be. I just need to borrow a laptop for the day, so if you could tell me who's in charge here... His smile has turned into a full-on grin now. I could have fun with this moment, I really could, he says conversationally. But alas, it'd take too long, and you'd get in trouble, and you'd hate me, and then we'd never be friends. He sighs dramatically. Come on, I'll get you set up with something. He starts to walk to the door, and I scurry after him. Wait, are you sure you're allowed to do this? I'm sure, he says as I fall in step next to him. What if Taylor finds out? Will you be okay? He chuckles and comes to an abrupt halt just past the kitchen. I do too. Like I said, I'd love to draw this out into some epic game of tease the new girl, but I think my manners are already dangerously lacking. I should have done this when you first walked into the room. He sticks out his hand to me. I'm Bennett Taylor, but everyone's called me Taylor since Pee Wee football, so you can too. He gives me a cheeky smile, and I wonder how many girls have fallen for that grin since Pee Wee football. I take his hand in my own and smile back. How is this guy anyone's boss? He can't be older than 30. But then, I guess not many people at this company are. Everyone here has one thing in common, though. They may have different styles, different ethnicities, and different backgrounds, but they're all the coolest people you've ever met. And this guy is definitely one of them. I'm Landon Brinkley. Nice to meet you. We turn and keep walking. How exactly were you going to pull off the epic game? I ask after a second. Oh, you know, misdirection, misadventure. Almost all my ideas center around telling you that Big Pretty was the boss just to watch you embarrass yourself. And Big Pretty is? One of our drivers. He can be a little intimidating. He smiles but doesn't look at me. Well, that's not very nice. I can't help but smile a little, too. I know, Brinkley. That's why I resisted temptation. I guess chivalry isn't dead. No, ma'am. He touches the brim of an imaginary hat, and I roll my eyes dramatically, which only makes him chuckle. Back in my corner, I'm busy taking notes while McKenna runs through my to-do list. And Lee's team should have linen samples for the Kessler Glenn wedding. I don't mean to interrupt him, but I actually squeal at the mention of Hollywood's It couple. His eyes narrow into slits. I don't need to remind you that you signed a confidentiality agreement, do I? My face falls. Of course not. I won't mention it to anyone. I'm just such a huge fan of Kira Glenn. I can't believe I'll be working on her wedding. I wouldn't say you'll be working on it so much as running around in the background schlepping. You won't even be doing that if Sayla finds out you're a starfucker.
What did he just say? I can't even say the words. I've never heard the phrase before, but the way he just spat it at me means it's definitely not a good thing.
Brinkley, I'm going to tell you the most important lesson you'll learn, and I expect you to commit it to memory since I don't have the time to hire a new intern. Are you ready? Even though he's being condescending, I nod, with the all-day smile plastered on my face. The celebrity clients are everything. Let me say it again. Everything. They're the most important part of this whole deal. He swings his index finger in a wide lasso, gesturing to the whole office. They're the bread and butter. They're who make it possible for SSE to charge what it does. They're where we get the press and the clout. And she'd stab her own mother before she'd risk her reputation with A-list clients. Nod if you understand. I swallow nervously and nod. So like I said, the most important lesson is this. Piss off a celebrity client and you can find another job. Serious as a heart attack, no joke. I nod again. He looks at me through narrowed eyes as if assessing my understanding of the topic. And then continues on as if the whole celebrity aside hasn't taken place. Next, I need you to pull some entertainment options for the learner bar mitzvah. Use the binders out front. You know, I was wondering yesterday if y'all have ever considered creating Pinterest boards for each event element. Or even the event itself. It'd be so much more efficient than the binders and I can... How about you work here for more than a week before you start trying to change business practices? He bites out. Damn it. I'll never learn to keep my mouth shut. I nod again. I'm getting really good at expressing chagrin with a single bob of my head. Now, as for the mitzvah, I also need you to check with operations on the delivery of the quipote. He rubs the space where his glasses meet his nose like he's already exhausted. It's only 10:18 a.m. They're supposed to have hand-stitched anchors on them, but Mrs. Lerner sent a panicked email at like 3 this morning freaking out because Ari went to another mitzvah last weekend and that kid had anchor quipote and we can't possibly have the same thing this weekend. We'll need to reorder sailboat quipote instead. I nod again. Like I have any clue what he just said, I write a note to myself in the top corner of my page. Google quipote. Spelling? Question mark? McKenna pushes himself to his feet, and the sound makes me look up. Time for the all-hands meeting, he says, slipping back into his pinstripe jacket. He considers me for a moment, like I'm a particularly interesting species of insect. Fine. You can come. Say nothing. He says this as if he's answering the question I hadn't asked. I follow him quickly out the door with my notebook in my hands. We walk the length of the office before coming to the door of the conference room. One whole side of the room is lined with large windows that show off a postcard view of Beverly Hills. In the middle of the room is a long glass conference table, surrounded on all sides by Louis XIV acrylic ghost chairs. I run my fingers reverently along the back of one. I've never seen these chairs in person, and I can't believe they use them as conference chairs. Actually, of course they use them as conference chairs. McKenna is typing feverishly on his smartphone, but he takes the chair to the right of the table's head and nods for me to sit next to him. All around us, the room is quickly filling with staff members. Then it hits me. All hands, as in all hands on deck. I try and stop my smile from forming, but it's really tough. I'm so excited to be included. The beautiful people are finding their seats and sipping on lattes and chatting about everything from a favorite Pinot Noir to a new band someone saw last night at Hotel Cafe. It's all so very LA, and I can't believe I'm here in the midst of it. Mika walks in the room with a large sketch pad under one arm and gold oversized headphones on her ears. She's wearing leather leggings and wedge sneakers in black suede that I didn't even know existed before seeing them on her feet. Her oversized black t-shirt is falling off one shoulder and has a screen print of an angry cat on the front. On anyone else, that shirt would look ridiculous, but somehow she manages to make it, like, the coolest cat t-shirt ever. I look down at my too short dress and sigh. I need to go shopping. Miko sits down across the table and looks up just as Sayla and Quaid walk in the door. The whole room goes silent, except for Sayla, who's on her phone. Quade takes the seat across from McKenna, and Sayla sits down at the helm. And then we all just sit there. Sayla chats on her phone as if she's got nothing better to do, as if the room full of people waiting for her doesn't have anything better to do either. No, of course I don't. You promised you were taking me out. She's smiling and happy. Her voice is oozing flirtatiousness. That's not true. I loved your last selection. It's quiet as she waits for the person on the phone to argue the point. She laughs deep in her throat. Well, perhaps you should try a little harder to impress me? She asks with an over-the-top pout. Ew. Arf! I look down the table to Miko, who rolls her eyes and leans back in her chair, getting comfortable. Clearly, this is nothing new, and we might be here a while. I wonder if the person on the other end of the phone realizes Sayla's having this chat with a captive audience around her. I can't wait, Brody. See you then, she says, breathless and far too sexy for the workplace. In quick succession, the phone is off her ear and now in her hands. She's reading something on the screen. She starts to type. She doesn't look up and the room stays quiet, waiting for her. Quade, I assume I'm not the only one with a million other things to do, Sayla says without looking up from her tiny screen. All hint of the flirty girl is gone. Apparently, that's the gunshot we've all been waiting for, because Quade leaps from her seat with the eagerness of a thoroughbred on race day. She looks down at the iPad she's holding, and then to the far end of the table. Learner Mitzvah? Taylor, can you tell us what's going on with production? I look down the table at Taylor. Despite the bad boy looks and his age, he holds the attention of the room with confidence. We're good. Rentals are delivered on Friday. AV loads in that afternoon. Client was annoyed about the need for on-site security to watch it all overnight, but it can't be helped. Timeline is finished. Walker sent it out this morning. Taylor points to a woman sitting next to him. Sunset? Sayla says without looking up. Is that a question or a statement? Man, I wish I understood this lingo. 7:13, Taylor answers. So apparently it was a question. We're going to have to see what we can get away with there. Sayla looks up. Let me see the timeline. She reaches out towards Quade, who's already handing her the iPad. But instead of grabbing the tablet, she seizes one of Quade's hands. Is this the new metallic polish from OPI? She looks closer at Quade's manicure. It is? Quade answers, a little unsure. But just on the fringe, they call it an inverted French tip? Sayla takes another half second to inspect the nails while the room holds its breath. It's fabulous, Q, she finally decrees, and Quade's gaunt frame literally ripples as she preens under the compliment. I saw it on someone's later gram, she tells Sayla, and evidently the room at large because she raised her voice confidently. It looks a lot like what Probl's models had on at the last show. They're so on trend, Q. Let's do something like this at the Riverton party. Maybe on the servers? Sayla's voice is sweet and playful, and she suddenly seems exactly like I thought she would be, like the coolest girl in school. If you can just impress her, she'll make you cool too. Definitely, Quade answers and hands off the iPad. It's about now that I remember I was told to take notes. I don't know which part of this conversation is important, so I just start writing down everything I hear. The room is quiet again as Sayla contemplates the screen in front of her. It's really tight. She looks down the table at the production team, seeming annoyed, and her cool girl moment is over. There's two bands, a party host, and the kids performing a violin solo. The dinner is six courses, we have four food trucks for the teenagers, and there's a Venetian dessert table. Taylor throws an irked look at the culinary arts team. Revere responds with a dramatic shrug as if to say, not my fault. And the klezmer band during cocktail hour. There's no other option with the timing. What time is strike? Sayla asks, looking back down at the screen. Midnight, Taylor says. My head volleys back and forth between them like I'm at a tennis match. I have no idea what they're saying at all, but it's obviously a hot topic because Sayla is radiating annoyance. It's tight, Sayla says again. We'll get it all in, Taylor says, cool as a cucumber. Sayla looks back down at the screen, dismissing the conversation. I know now where McKenna learned that little trick. Floral? Quade looks to an older woman three seats down from her, The woman has bright red hair and a petite build. I'm a shorty, but she's so small I feel like she might fit inside my pocket. When she speaks, she's got a thick British accent, and I immediately imagine her as some sort of sprightly garden gnome. We lost the lady slippers. We're still unsure they'll make it out of customs, and even if they do, I don't trust the quality after so much time. We've reworked it with failure.